The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 30th of July, 2020. On the podcast today, Clive Beattie, Acting Chief Executive Officer of On The Market, discusses the recent progress made by the business as outlined at their AGM today. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers the following company: news from Lloyds, from AstraZeneca and Royal Dutch Shell. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists, in fact, top 10 versions of both these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see a host, a raft of other content. In fact, there's one there, SP Angel View. It's a morning view. Cities scramble to contain the third wave of flooding of the Yangtze River. That's in China there. There's a Malky's blog on oil and gas. Biome Technologies sees continued growth in bioplastics division. Europa Metals sees significant increase in stock. So lots of blogs there. There's a video there as well of Expedia. And also, don't forget, our COVID-19 index. What's the biggest rise of it today? Wow. Not one stock is rising on our COVID-19 index. They're all fallers. The stocks are non-movers: Symphony Environmental, Inspiration Health. But the biggest faller is Tizian Life Sciences. That's down almost 10%. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Clive Beattie, Acting Chief Executive Officer of On The Market. OTMP is the ticker there. Clive, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Thank you once again. Good to speak to you.
Yeah, you just released an AGM statement. I always like to read the AGM, especially if it's positive as well, but I always like to read them so you give insight into the AGMs, I suppose, and it's very positive. We'll dig into that. If someone's listening right now, Clive, and they're thinking, On The Market, I've sort of heard of that. What's that about? Just summarise what the business is about, please.
Of course. So On The Market is a UK property portal where we would list properties that agents are looking to sell on behalf of their customers or to let, or new homes developers on their new homes developments. And we would list those, and consumers will come to our portal, onthemarket.com, and be able to browse and look for properties to either buy or rent. And really our objective is to offer, you know, the advertisers, the agents, new homes developers a first-class service, but also at a sustainably fair price, whilst becoming the go-to property for the go-to portal for property seekers.
Yeah, and if anyone's listened to the previous podcast, I've been a real-life case study here, and I have your app, I have Rightmove's app, and I've given examples of when you've been 24 hours ahead of Rightmove in sending me properties in my area that I've got in my filter. So that's very. And how do you just remind us, how do you manage to do that, Clive?
So we actually have, and because we are agent-backed, so we've got something like 65% of the shares in agents' hands, over 3,000 agent shareholders. So we have a very strong alignment of interest with agents and support from them, for which we're very grateful. But that enables us to make things that the others can't do. And exactly as you say, what we call new and exclusive. So a number of our agent branches will, where they get a new instruction, will load it to our portal first. So if you're a serious buyer and you want to see things as soon as they come to the market, you need to be on our site to see those properties in advance of them being listed on any other portal.
Yeah. Okay. Well, your AGM statement today, ahead of the meeting, you sort of break it down really into operations, financials, demand, and then clients. So let's do that. So operationally, how's it going, Clive?
Very well indeed. I mean, obviously, I think probably people are aware from just reading the press that the property markets are very buoyant at the moment. They have been since mid-May when the restrictions were lifted from COVID. And that activity has been helped by things like the stamp duty relief that the Chancellor has brought in. But nevertheless, you know, in terms of our own performance, we are still seeing a, you know, very strong performance. Our total advertisers is almost 14,000 at the end of June. And in June itself, we generated 1.8 million leads, which is something like 134 per advertiser, a record for us. You know, if I give an example, that's up about 40% on the average of the year to Jan 20. where we averaged about 96. So a very strong performance. You know, we're still seeing very strong traffic coming through, you know, 6 million visits plus per week. So I think that's showing that the portal is engaging those consumers that are active in the property market, and they are providing back value back to our advertisers through leads and through generating interest for the advertisers' properties.
Yeah, yeah. And throughout this period, financially, you know, how have you been managing cash?
Well, that's been, you know, we've said a number of times now, reporting through the COVID crisis, the impact of that, that we're very keen to preserve our cash and to, you know, make sure that we got through the COVID crisis and came out ready to support our agents and customers. So we've been pleased with that. You can see that from May, when we last reported, end May to end June, we've had a net increase of about 0.6 million of cash. So we're at 9.4 million. We do have some deferred creditors where we've taken advantage of, for example, HMRC have allowed deferred payments on PAYE and VAT, and they are 2.3. But nevertheless, we've, you know, we've managed to conserve cash by cutting our costs to match our revenues. You know, revenues, we are still offering discounts to our customers. We continue to do that through August and September. We think that's the right thing to do. And what we've done is cut our costs back accordingly to make sure that we can preserve our cash.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you mentioned there that, you know, there's been a bit of pent-up demand there, and the Chancellor's stamp duty has helped. Now, let's talk about the, you know, your clients here, the agents here. Has there been a change in the way they've been, you know, interacting with you in any way, or have they talked, well, have you given you any feedback on the market itself? What's happening at the moment?
I think what we've seen throughout the COVID period is actually agents are much more focused now on both the structures of the competing portals and also the long-term objectives of the competing portals. And I think the real differentiator for us, which I touched on earlier, is our agent ownership. So as I say, a very strong alignment of interests. And alongside that, not only are we committed to supporting full-service professional agents, but we're also committed to sustainably fair pricing for those agents. And I think that resonates very well with them, you know, in these troubled times particularly. And what we're seeing that's encouraging is, you know, we put out a couple of new offers to see if further agents wanted to join us as shareholders. And we've close to 600 more branches under those offers during this period. You know, we've seen a very big uplift in the number of branches with us exclusively. So as we said in our statement, it's up 42% year on year, just over 1,600 branches exclusively with us. And that says to me, actually, now, if you look at all those statistics and the operational statistics, you know, we are actually functioning as a portal, and there is genuine competition in the marketplace. You know, agents are able to choose who they list with. And even if they are listing just with us, they are still able to conduct their business to prosper. So that says to me there's now genuine competition and genuine choice. And that was really what the premise of On the Market was about, was to foster that choice and allow agents to determine which of the portals they wish to list on, rather than, you know, seeing one as a must-have.
Yeah, and I suppose it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, you know, for the clients there, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship, and you know, you both need each other, and to thrive, I suppose you both need to do well, you know, and so they you're probably more loyal to them because you're part of your shareholder base. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
I think so. And, you know, people sometimes question, is there a conflict? But I don't believe so, because actually, you know, on our listing fees, you know, the support of agents is key. And obviously we offer a fair fee, and we don't see that growing astronomically in the way that, you know, they felt other portals have done year on year. But actually that platform is a very powerful platform for our more medium term. You know, in the short term, there's a lot of market share and revenue growth that we can get through just those listing fees. But in the medium term, even if we max out on that huge growth there and are onto a more sustainable growth level going forward, we've got lots of opportunity for other products and services to help agents and to work with them that we can then put through the platform, you know, which is a very powerful distribution platform. So, you know, that's a very exciting future. But in the short term, as I say, I think our alignment with interests should see us hopefully through this crisis emerge stronger and with greater support.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, Clive, as always, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making but are not yet following the story, just give them the three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, I mean, probably summarising some of the points we touched on, but the first is actually the short-term revenue potential. You know, we've got thousands of agents on paying, but we've got some thousands that are either discounted or free of charge. And the opportunity to grow our revenues and for that revenue to drop through to a profitable bottom line activity is very big in the short term. So you know, that's the first thing, is the short term revenue potential through market share and paying contracts. Second, I'd say, is using that platform, as I say, in the longer term or the medium to longer term, to then distribute other products and services, you know, at market value, which give an ongoing growth potential for the business. And then thirdly, coming back to the key differentiator, which is our proposition, you know, the fact that we're agent-owned, the fact that agents hopefully will choose to support us because of the ownership they have in us and the ability to align with us and become shareholders. You know, and that's illustrated by these, you know, close to 600 branches already signed up and the exclusive ones with us. So, you know, more of that. If we can work with agents in the coming months and we and they support each other, I think we've got a very powerful proposition.
Excellent stuff, Clive. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks, Austin. Have a great day.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Very well. Very busy. My goodness, today is just the epic of all epics in terms of earnings, I think, for this summer. Yeah. So, yeah, very busy, but all good information, I guess.
Yeah, do you know what?
Through it.
Yeah, on opening bell this morning, I got a chart alert, a price alert on Lloyds. I thought, oh, hang on, it doesn't look good. Because normally I put them in extremes, pretty much, when it hits RSIs oversold and overbought. And Lloyds hit, I think, 30, which is oversold. And I thought, what's going on there then? So I don't know where they are at the moment, but they had news out. So what's the deal? Have they dropped down? They bounced back? What's happening?
Yeah, no, Lloyd's shares, at least when I last looked a few minutes ago, were down around about 6% on the day, which is not very good, particularly given, of course, they've been under a lot of pressure over not just this year, but multiple years. You know, banks have been out of favour for a long time. So quarter two numbers, at face value, they've been making a bit of progress on things such as costs. Cost control is still good. The rollout digital banking is still pushing on afresh. You know, we're all you know, shifting online, etc. So that's all good. The trouble is that they fessed up to another couple of billion of extra impairments in the second quarter. You may recall 3 months ago, just at sort of the cusp of the start of the lockdown, they pushed through just 1.5 billion odd of impairments, saying this was their best estimate. And they were quite pessimistic about the economy and the outlook. But yeah, they've set another 2.5 billion for the second quarter. They've given guidance for the full year. And if my maths is correct, that they're sort of implying that there's further impairments to come. And these impairments are coming from people not paying their mortgage, people not paying their credit card balance or something like that. Bad debts from those sorts of sources. And given, you know, Lloyds is a fairly sort of mainstream kind of bank nowadays. It's mostly mortgages. It's got a credit card arm. And obviously there's a bunch of personal loans, some corporate loans as well, small business loans and related. But all of those areas are the ones which they're worried about and are contributing to the impairments. And of course, impairments are the worst thing if you're a bank, because that's money you're never going to get back. You know, unfortunately, if somebody defaults or doesn't pay or whatever, not much of it. I mean, with a mortgage, yes, maybe your underlying have got some kind of property that you could ultimately sell on, but many of these loans won't have such underpinning. So the bank takes it where it hurts. So they might talk about a wonderful capital ratio and everything else, but unfortunately, investors are selling first and sort of asking questions later.
Yeah, they're down now, looking then about 8%. And I did open the RNS, started to scroll down, saw sways and sways. First of all, there was three RNSs, one of two, there was something else there, I don't know. So I got the one of two, and I scrolled down, I couldn't be bothered to get to the bottom with it. Oh, just wait. But I'm looking at now, and just the income statement here. And so last year, 6 months of June, they made a profit there, started a pre-tax profit of 2.8 billion. This year, a loss of 602 million. So you can see the difference there. Yeah, so I suppose that's all you need to know. I mean, like I said, and there's more to come. Oh, down 9% now. So they're dropping as we're speaking, Chris. So it's not very good.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's all the impairment. I mean, they would say, you know, on an underlying basis, they're making money. But the thing is, you've always got to think about impairments, bad debts and related whenever you're thinking about a bank. So the consensus clearly is that banks, you don't want to own them. unclear because they're double geared to the economy and all of that sort of stuff. Yeah. So let me put a case for the defence. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Which would be their tangible book value is 51p now, and so that means they're trading at around about half tangible book value. So what's that saying? Well, that's basically saying that half your, in a very naive fashion, that half your book, i.e. your book of mortgages and loans and everything else, half of that is rubbish and the rest is all right. Now, obviously, that's quite a big haircut, to say the least.
Yeah.
And it's quite that neat and tidy because there's leverage and other issues and obviously you've got other costs and whatever. But it's clearly an indication that there is huge pessimism towards the space. And I think this is where, if you like, the value story comes in. The trouble is you could have made that story when it was trading at any price below book value because you'd have said, well, you know, how bad can it get? The trouble is the pandemic makes it, you know, is in a way, if it was a normal recession, you perhaps would have precedents and you could map it and whatever. But as they've talked about, you know, they've been upfront and good in terms of providing loans to businesses and everything else, you know, holidays for mortgage payments. The trouble is that is good short term in the sense they're helping the government out, etc. But ultimately, commercially, obviously, it just builds potentially more liability. So that's the difficult call. How bad is it going to get? And ultimately, you know, from that you define whether paying half tangible book value for the shares today is good value or not. It is simply put a geared play on the economy and the pandemic profile. That's all it is. But that would be the case for the defence. That is where you would find your value. Personally, I don't own this. But that would be how I would see it. That is a good debate to be had. It doesn't feel like it today, but that is the pushback on this one. That's where the value is potentially over time.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think, you know, like I said, we've got this uncertainty. We don't know how long the economy is going to be at a reduced rate, how many businesses are going to go through until we recover. It's just an open-ended question, isn't it? We have no idea. And if you look at the share price, like I said, you know, you can see this value here and... we can go back now and look at the share price, and literally it was back at this level in 2012, and then previously that, the Great Financial Crisis, 2009. So that's where we are. That's historically, you know, it's quite significant. So, but again, you need patience. What, you know, is a value investor. I'd personally wait until a bit of recovery happens, hopefully, and then maybe relook at it. But we could be bouncing on the bottom here for a while, couldn't we?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you go back and look at the global financial crisis, and you remember those Northern Rock or Northern Croc, as it was called hilariously at the time. Northern Rock, obviously, that went belly up. We all know that, lines outside the branches and all of that. But if you look at what happened after, is it went into government ownership and other companies bought bits of it and whatever else. But if you look at that book of mortgages, ultimately there were some rubbishy old loans there which did go wrong. But ultimately, when it went into runoff, people made money on it. And so if you could, you know, get your fairy's magic wand out and buy Lloyds today and say to yourself, right, I'm just going to do a runoff. You know, I'm not going to look to grow this. I'm just going to run it off over time, over the next 10 years, 15 years, whatever. What would you make? Would you make an advance to today's equivalent share price or not? The answer is you probably would. And so that's the value argument. It's a difficult one, as you say, because the thing is, we're all looking at the pandemic short term. You get your magic fairy wand over the pandemic and sort that out, then the banks instantaneously look a lot better.
We bought it down to the simples. It's buy low, sell high, and we are at an historic low. And if you believe in a couple of years' time the economy will be in a better place, then so will the share price of Lloyds, all things being equal, won't it? So it comes down to that, really, doesn't it? Sometimes we look too close and we have too short term a view as an investor, but over the long term, like I said, we're at an historic low, and it tends not to stay down here for a long time unless Lloyds itself does something badly wrong. But I can't see this being, you can argue this. Is it as bad as the Great Financial Crisis, where financial industries and businesses were going through? And you think, well, you know, we've got businesses going through, and the buck stops at the bank generally, doesn't it? So it can be argued, it can be as bad, really.
Yeah, it is. I think it's different. This time around, the trouble is, it's when you get pressure from the government to sort of do things like keep on forwarding loans to companies to keep them going. So sort of these zombie loans, effectively. Yeah. That's where you... I mean, I've studied things like the Japanese banks, for example, like their various points of malaise over the last 25 odd years. And the thing is, yeah, there ultimately is a flaw, yes. But half book, half tangible book value, that not necessarily is the value that it would suggest. What you need is a bit of help from on high to say, right, either we're getting the other side of this, but also we're having a proper commercial backdrop, which is companies can go bust. Yeah. And that's sad for everybody involved, but ultimately that's business. Better that than that than trying to, you know, keep everybody kind of going forever and ever, and obviously things ultimately relying just on perma subsidy.
Yeah, absolutely. And what happens is when you keep, you know, these zombie businesses, like you say, afloat for a while, the banks forced to do that will almost become a zombie business themselves, and that is really bad. That's where you don't want to go, I suppose. Cool. Anything else? What's next, Chris?
So let's go from the sublime to the ridiculous, probably the other way around, the ridiculous to the sublime, I guess, which would be AstraZeneca. So AstraZeneca is the other side of all of this. I think I read somewhere recently, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure AstraZeneca is now the biggest company by market cap on the FTSE 100. It's certainly right up there. And Zeneca, obviously, they've been in the news a lot recently. They're doing various COVID trials and everything else. But clearly, it's a healthcare pharmaceutical company, bunch of interesting products across a wide range of diseases and areas for medical treatment. They're massively in favour. The shares, I think, responded well to the numbers which were out today. I think they were up a couple of percent when I last looked. Yeah. And what do they say? Reiterated guidance. You know, they're talking about a teen sort of double digit increase in EPS this year, and then obviously they're all wrapped up in the COVID thing, and you never know, maybe their vaccine, their treatment, which obviously they're doing with the University of Oxford, just maybe is the one. You know, who knows? We'll find out, I guess, over the next 6 months or so. But yeah, AstraZeneca is very much in favour, and it's interesting because we talked about Lloyd's, you know, a few minutes ago about value, potentially deep value, you know, unheralded value, but you know, hugely disliked at the moment. Is Zeneca the other way around, in the sense that what are you paying today for AstraZeneca shares? You are paying a multiple, an earnings multiple in excess of 20 times. They are pushing forward, but you know that's still quite punchy for what they're putting on the table today or respectively tomorrow. Mm. But it's safe. People feel safe with it, and hence why the shares are kicking around all-time highs. So, you know, the market is a funny thing in the sense that you have this sort of this massive fear and greed kind of psychological element. And the greed element, or the hope element, or the comfort element, whatever you want to call it, is certainly with AstraZeneca today. Personally, I don't own this one either. I mean, that's clearly a poor sort of choice of mine over recent months and years as well. But there you go. You can't hold everything. But yeah, looking at it today, do I think it's good value? I struggle to say that. I guess unless they do chance upon the thing which pulls away the COVID issue, and then I guess they can sort of tell people whatever they like in terms of a share price.
Yeah, I've heard that apparently, you know, people are that there's not going to be a lot of money made. But do you know what? Going back a second, I compared AstraZeneca's fundamentals, the full year results last year, with GlaxoSmithKline, and Glaxo's margins are better, their growth's better, but the share price isn't performing as well. I don't understand that. It's just like AstraZeneca seemed to be the favoured stock out of those two, isn't it?
I mean, to be fair, I think the thing about AstraZeneca is a lot of hope is in the pipeline. This is the trouble with pharmaceutical companies, for us sort of non-medical type people, trying to work out the validity, the potential scale of some of the forward products. There is a lot of hope that some of the stuff that Zeneca's, and they talked about it today in the statement, in their pipeline, not just the COVID stuff, but all the other bits, are coming to the fore very nicely. Whilst Glaxo, it is not completely bereft of stuff in its forward pipeline, but it's got slightly different exposures, a bit more historic. It's got its consumer exposures as well, which is a little bit different. So you put all of that together and, yeah, slightly different beast. So Zeneca is definitely a hope machine, shall we say. People are saying, my goodness, it's pushing in the right direction. Yeah. And the COVID's just taking it to the next level, basically.
Yeah, and I suppose when you step out into those brave things, like you know, AstraZeneca for COVID, and they say they're going to have a vaccine at the boss there before the end of the year and all that stuff. It's you know, it puts yourself, it makes you strive, doesn't it, for that to achieve above everyone else's levels, and you've got to put yourself out there, I suppose. What's interesting though is that they're apparently not going to be making money off, you know, any vaccine. Not this round, anyway, which is quite clever, because they're saying that, you know, the vaccine will get better. The initial, you know, they said it'll be quite good. It'll be good for people who need it, not for the general population who don't probably need it. But then it'll get better, and then they'll start making money on the second doses, third doses, the iterations of the vaccine rather than the first one, because it's very much seen as helping the global community by killing this virus first. It's quite interesting. I think the vaccine race is very interesting indeed. Cool. Anything else? Any other big companies reporting, Chris?
Yeah, we've gone from Lloyd's to AstraZeneca. Got to take a quick look at Royal Dutch Shell. Mm-hmm. It used to be the biggest company in the UK market, but its star has fallen recently. I mean, they announced a couple of months ago big impairments. The dividend was getting the kibosh to a good extent was being debased, I think, as they put it. So the numbers today are unbelievably messy. You know, I don't think I've ever seen a net income line down 302% before, which is what they put at the top of their statement. That's all because of the impairment charges, writing stuff down and whatever. So hard to say exactly what the hell's happening at Royal Dutch Shell because the numbers are so messy. But structurally, I think the reason why the shares have been disappointing is not just the fact that the oil price has been low and obviously famously mildly negative very, very briefly a few months ago, because they're an integrated oil company and actually the oil price per se is not that important. It's more about the sort of the whole concept of energy and related. And their problem, I think, is just this slow decline in the growth of oil demand and the rise of alternatives. And the trouble is that Royal Dutch Shell, it's a one-trick pony. You know, ultimately, it is aligned to that big oil machine, be it on obviously the extraction, the exploration, or the chemicals or refining side. It's involved in all of those mechanisms. And the trouble is that when you're moving to a world where either you're talking about carbon taxes, a green agenda, the rise of alternatives, what do they do? You know, they've been fiddling around at the edges, trying to do a few of those things, getting a little bit into renewables or the more utility side. But none of these things potentially have the margins of their core kind of oil and gas business. And the trouble is that gives them a bit of a problem. They've got some real sort of existential angst over it, effectively. And I don't think they're any closer to solving it. I heard the CEO on one of these financial TV channels earlier. And, you know, he was saying, oh, you know, it's all about managing the business effectively and efficiently for the longer term. But it felt to me more like just the longer term decline, to be honest, because, you know, these businesses are just inexorably going to be smaller and less relevant over the next couple of generations.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely, if you look at the ESG movement and all that stuff, and the outflow just from, you know, for the oil and gas companies, it seems like there's, the attention is elsewhere, isn't it? The heat and the interest is elsewhere now. These oil companies are in decline by the same bit. It's one of those things people, big institutions seem to want to avoid, don't they?
Yeah, well, the trouble is, I think big institutions were so heavy with these sorts of names and that they have just been perma sellers now for a few years. And actually, if you look, I bet if the listeners look at their corporate pension funds, I bet their corporate pension funds are chock-a-block full with this stuff as well. They've probably got a whole load of Lloyds as well and hopefully a bit of AstraZeneca. But they'll certainly have a bunch of Dutch and Royal Dutch and BP because, of course, it's been a dividend machine. Pension funds like that and related. The trouble is, it's still paying a dividend, and even it being debased, it's still an all right dividend, you know, way better than money in the bank. But the trouble is, I think the whole industry is just under pressure. And, you know, when I look at the shares, I think to myself, why bother? You know, you can make a value case for Lloyd's based on that. No company like that should ultimately, it's either going to be trading Lloyd's at negligible price to book or about 1x price to book. You know, where we are now, it's sort of in limbo in the middle. Zeneca, you can make your calls about that in terms of pipeline and everything else. I think it's a bit overdone personally, but you know, people can draw conclusions. Raw Dutch Shell, it feels just like the slow squeeze, the slow decline. And as I say, they need to work out where they're going to go. They could redeploy capital, but the trouble is anything they redeploy it into, I just don't think it's going to be as remunerative. So, yeah, it's a bit of a lose-lose really for them. And, yes, it will bounce. Sure, if the oil price puts on $10 or $20, Raw Dutch Shell, just as a muscle reaction, will bounce. Yeah. But I think that's more opportunity to get out if you've still got some rather than anything else.
Yeah, I believe it'll be it's one of the sectors so unloved that it'll have a rally. And I don't know what will stimulate this, but it'll be a final hurrah and people just get in there and it'll rally, and then all of a sudden we'll have the full big sell-off then and it'll come back down to where we are. But when you look at 24 quid a share, Royal Dutch Shell, 27 quid a share in May 2018, now 11 quid now. A lot of it, of course, down to the oil price and all that, but yes, it's very volatile for a big stock, isn't it?
It is. And, and particularly with less dividend support now, in absolute terms, hasn't come down as in percentage, hasn't come down quite as much as you think because the shares come down. But, that's hardly a good thing. The bottom line is, I think investors are looking at this and saying, surely there are other things to be doing. If you can't find something a bit more interesting, then you probably should give up.
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous stuff. Chris, thanks for that, fella, and we'll catch up next week.
Sounds a plan. See you then.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Equatorial Palm Oil. Up 15% to 0.55 pence. At four, Lloyds Banking Group. They were down sort of close to 10% earlier on. They're down 7% now. We talked about them with Chris on the podcast at 26.4 pence. At three, Tiziana, just mentioned that top of the show. They're down close to 10%, 186. At two, Amiga Diagnostics, down 1.23% to 60.25 pence. And I was reading their RNS this morning, and they've got a bit of way to go, haven't they? I think that's why it's come off a little bit. Even though they've got a CE test marking for the COVID-19 lateral flow antibody test for professional use, they get this certified further or approval they need from the MHRA. They have to do a 2,000 volunteers test. Once complete, they'll allow them to seek final approval from that test after the test. So that's going to happen. And they reckon timeline-wise for producing these will be in place by September. They'll be able to produce around 100,000 tests per week, scaling up to 200,000 tests per week in October. So it seems a bit of a time off yet. Plus, they have to go through that regulatory approval. So there's a few hoops to jump through yet. But of course, testing is here for a long time, as we discussed with Chris Bailey on the podcast. Sorry, with Vadim Alexander on the podcast yesterday. So I don't think there's any rust. As long as they get it right, there'll be a market there for them, definitely, because the vaccine is going to be here before the end of the year. Well, maybe, but the majority of the population it won't. And so testing will be around and needed for a long time. Okay, so I think maybe some investors there having, a bit of impatience, maybe selling, saying, wow, a bit of time to wait yet. Okay, top five most liked RNSs. In fact, what's number one? Number one again, most followed company is Supply Atme Capital, SYME, down 21% to 0.0485 pence. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Big Dish, operational update. At four, Predator Oil and Gas, new corporate presentation. At three, Omega Diagnostics, update on progress of UK Rapid Test Consortium. At two, Polarian Imaging, scientific presentations on hyperpolarized xenon. And some good news there, actually, among the people people presenting at the virtual conferences over the next few months. Very impressive. And at white, do hold shares there. And at one, it's Monotech Pharma, Holdings in Company. Why would that get some likes there? It's Bank of America Corporation. They've got up to 4.42 below the threshold. Okay. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos. Appreciate it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.